mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, as if rising home prices and high mortgage rates weren't enough of a challenge, a new Bankrate report finds the hidden cost of home ownership is quickly becoming more than many first-time buyers are prepared for. Also this morning, Congressman Bob Latta joins us to discuss timely issues on Capitol Hill involving election security, national defense funding, and domestic energy production. And the message is clear and simple that every child deserves a voice, and you can help be that voice through CASA of Hancock County. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, June 18th, 2024. So yesterday, our good friend Brian Witta, who has been with us on the program a number of times, Brian posted on social media yesterday on Facebook. He actually looked this up. And yes, we were hotter than hell yesterday. We were at 97, 98 degrees. Well, my thermometer at my house at one point said 100. So we got to the triple digits, at least my place. And Brian looked it up, and it was 92 degrees yesterday in Hell, Michigan. So we were officially hotter than hell yesterday. And not only that, I thought it was interesting. Chris Vickers mentioned on his 6 o'clock newscast on WTOL last night that Toledo was 11 degrees hotter yesterday than Miami. It was 11 degrees hotter in Toledo than it was in Miami, Florida yesterday. In fact, he pointed out that the high temperature yesterday here in Northwest Ohio was above every city's official reading in the state of Florida. Every city in the state of Florida. So that's how often do you say in June that you want to go to Florida to cool off? I mean, that's just rather unusual. So yeah, very, very warm, and it is going to I'm not complaining, though, mind you. I am not complaining, because as I said yesterday, you can only complain one season out of the year. You will hear me complain all the time in the winter about it being cold, so you will never hear me complain about it being too hot in the summertime. And you know why? It's because my water pipes have never exploded because it's too hot. Never had a water pipe break because it was too hot. On a serious note, though, with the heat, obviously, you got to be very careful with this if you're going to be spending any time at all outdoors. My wife and I ran some errands yesterday, and it was uncomfortable to walk from the parking lot into the store just because the air you were breathing in was so hot. So it's just uncomfortable. You got to be very, very careful if you are exerting any sort of energy whatsoever. Here's something else that you may or may not have thought about. With the heat wave gripping much of the nation this week, experts are warning people who take certain medications to be very careful. Those would include medicines for high blood pressure, allergies, and mental health. Diuretics, which help the body produce more urine, can lead to dehydration in extreme heat. Beta blockers can impede the body's ability to regulate temperature, and certain antipsychotics can affect the ability to produce sweat, which is how the body cools itself naturally in the heat. So these medications can, and of course there are those medications like insulin that have to be refrigerated and so on. So we know that, but you may or may not realize some of the side effects of some of these other medications that may make it more difficult for one to deal with the heat. And so you got to be very careful with those. So good advice from the medical experts. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started. Did you hear yesterday Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced new recommendations to improve safety and traffic flow on US 23 north of Columbus? So and this is great news for folks in Northwest Ohio. If you ever drive to Columbus, how do most of us go to Columbus? We take 30 over to 23. We take 23 into Columbus, right? And I often say there is a McDonald's restaurant in Delaware that is almost exactly 1 hour's drive from my house to that. And then it's like another hour from there to basically any place in Columbus you want to go to, whether it's the Ohio State campus or to, you know, like Polaris or to the airport. So it takes you an hour to drive to Delaware. Then it takes another hour to drive through Delaware just because 23 is such a mess. Daily travel on the 23-mile stretch between Worthington and Waldo currently exceeds the design capacity of the road by 30%, causing regular traffic congestion and a number of crashes in that stretch of road as well, and that's what they're even more concerned about. So ODOT has made a series of recommendations that would ultimately eliminate nearly all of the 39 traffic signals along that corridor, that 23-mile stretch. 39 traffic signals in that 23-mile stretch of US 23. That's just nuts. They want to bring the total number of traffic signals down to a maximum of 7, maybe even less. That would speed up the flow of traffic, to be sure. The proposal would widen lanes, add several interchanges, and construct overpasses, all at a cost of between $1.5 and $2 billion, roughly. But for my money, if you've ever driven US 23 headed into Columbus, I'd gladly pay $2 billion. You can take it out of, I will pay personally $2 billion. If I had won the lottery, I would give you that $2 billion so that you could fix that road. Experts also looking into a long-term direct freeway connection between Columbus and Toledo. And that analysis is expected to be done at the end of 2024. And that would be interesting because if they create a new highway connecting Toledo to Columbus directly, I'm not sure if we would necessarily want that in the Findlay area. Because as of right now, people who are traveling from Southern Michigan or from the Toledo area and heading to Columbus come right through Findlay and may stop, get something to eat, fill up with gas, whatever it might happen to be. And that's an economic thing. And I'm not sure that we would want a highway from Toledo to Columbus to bypass the Flag City. So that will be an interesting analysis to pay attention to when that's released. But the idea of reducing the congestion on US 23 is good news. That would be excellent news. My wife and I drove that just the other day. And again, it was like every time I drive that stretch of road, that's one of the reasons I hate driving to Columbus. I hate driving to Columbus. I'd drive anywhere else first then go to Columbus because it is such a mess in that stretch of 23. So good news there. Let me see. What else is going on? Among the first things you need to know, every day we have to have something to be concerned about, something to worry about. You know, the hand-wringing story of the year. We're all concerned about this. Gray whales living off the coasts of Oregon and Washington are getting smaller. Research from Oregon State University found that over the last 20 years, the average adult gray whale is 13% smaller than it once was, and about 5.5 feet shorter. Now, that's a sizable difference. These gray whales are smaller and shorter. Researchers say it could be a sign that this population of gray whales could be in decline. Smaller whales have smaller calves, smaller offspring, and that puts them at risk of other predators. They say the decline in body length could also be an overall sign about the environment. So, again, it's the environment. We're killing the planet. Starting by killing the gray whales in the Pacific Northwest. So that's what we're worried about today. Every day you're going to have a story about that. The doom of our planet and is seen in the size and length of the gray whales. This, I thought, is a really interesting idea. You know, most companies, retail establishments, are looking to speed up the checkout process, right? That was one of the selling points of all of the self-checkout aisles, is that you could have 20 self-checkout aisles, check out 20 people at a time instead of having you stand in line for a checkout clerk. And the idea is to get you through the checkout process and get you on your way faster. Most of us complain that checking out of a store takes too long. So while most companies are looking to speed up that process, one supermarket in Japan is testing the idea of slowing the whole process down. The store in Japan is testing a lane specifically for the elderly and the disabled, because they say those individuals can feel rushed by other people who are looking to check out quickly, and they can make them uncomfortable. They can feel bad about holding up the line. So they decided to install a slow lane. Like, you've got the fast checkout lane, the quick lane for like 5 items or 10 items or less. This is the slow lane specifically for the elderly and the disabled. That's what they created for. But what they found is that the line has become popular for a wide portion of customers who simply dislike feeling rushed. In fact, the store claims that sales have increased by 10% since testing the slow lane. Customers in the slower lane can count their money without feeling rushed, bag groceries at their own pace, and chat with the cashier. Shoppers are permitted to spend up to 20 minutes at the register asking about promotions, payment options, and products. That is slow. You can take 20 minutes at the checkout register. That is a slow lane. I don't know if it would necessarily catch on here, but it's an interesting idea. And apparently they have... It is an idea whose time has come. And I think that is an idea whose time has come. Because what is it? These days we are so rushed through everything. Everything is go, 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 go. And it's an idea to just slow down. It's kind of a stop and smell the roses kind of thing. I'm not sure if the supermarket checkout line is where I'd necessarily, if I could choose any place to slow down the hectic pace of my life, I'm not sure that the supermarket checkout line would be the place that I would choose, but any port in the store. I mean, if that's where it's going to be, that's where it's going to be. It's kind of interesting. And finally, this morning, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, do you have a popular or unique wedding anniversary date? This is an online survey user on Reddit mapped out when the happiest couples tied the knot. And I guess he went around and he asked people. He took this big survey of people asking, you know, how happy they are in their marriage and then asking when they were married. And what he found is that the most popular dates for happy weddings, for happy marriages, if you get married on September 1st, August 25th, August 4th, and July 28th, those are the most popular dates: September 1st, August 25th, August 4th, July 28th. It says while there are fewer weddings, period, in the wintertime, most of them are spring, summer, fall, very few in the winter, there is a spike on Valentine's Day, February 14th. So there is that. So I guess you would, you know, put that in the running, sort of a runner-up honorary mention. But if you're looking to have a happy marriage, apparently those are the best dates to get hitched. So you're welcome if you are planning nuptials. You want to pick your date carefully, apparently. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
This is ONN. I'm Jay Fox on the Ohio News Network. The Ohio heat wave continued yesterday with daytime temperatures in the mid to upper 90s throughout most of the state and heat indices in the triple digits. Many communities statewide have opened emergency cooling shelters. Experts suggest that you limit your time outdoors and stay hydrated. Pop-up storms are a possibility in these weather conditions, and some storms could be severe. The Cleveland woman accused of fatally stabbing
23-year-old Julian Wood at a North Olmsted grocery store parking lot was in court Monday. Laura Queso with ONN affiliate WKYC-TV reports.
33-year-old Bianca Ellis is being held on a $5 million bond. Judge John Russo set the start of her trial for Monday, December 9th, with a final pretrial set for November 7th. Ellis was present in court for the hearing. The prosecutors also say an autopsy report for Julian Wood will be completed in the next 3 to 4 weeks.
The AMI Polymers plant in Toledo will remain closed for now as the court-ordered evacuation remains in place. Melissa Andrews with ONN affiliate WTOL-TV explains.
Last month, traces of arsenic, mercury, and zinc were found in the facility, which the city says indicated that chemicals had been improperly discharged. The city says it is working with the U.S. and Ohio EPA to oversee the cleanup.
For the Ohio News Network, I'm Jay Fox.
Well, in the coming week, we are going to get numbers on existing home sales and housing starts. And speaking of which, since 2020, home values, of course, have surged more than 40%. Mortgage rates have doubled and then some. And not only that, a new bank rate analysis finds that the unseen and often unaccounted for costs of owning a home have also gone up substantially. And joining us this morning with more on their latest hidden costs of home ownership study is bank rate analyst Jeff Ostrowski. Jeff, break down these numbers for us here.
Well, so we took a look at, as you described it, some of the hidden costs of home ownership or just the less than obvious things. So beyond the sale price or the purchase price and beyond the monthly principal and interest, we added up all the other things that go along with owning a home. So those are things like property taxes, homeowners insurance, power bills, and most importantly and most expensively is ongoing maintenance and repairs. And so nationally, we determined that that number is about $16,000 a year. Nationally, it's about $18,000 a year, up from $14,000 4 years ago, and up 26%, as you mentioned. And these numbers vary pretty widely across the country. So Hawaii, California, it's close to 30,000. Wow. Kentucky and Arkansas, it's below 12,000. Ohio is at the lower end of the range, so around $13,000.
Yeah. So you talk about some of the things that this index includes. Of those, what's the biggest driver of the increases that you're seeing?
Well, it's a variety of things. So our numbers show that the costs of homeownership, these after purchase costs, are up 26% over the past 4 years. So inflation cumulatively has been up 21% during that same 4 year period. So not completely out of line, but home prices have gone up quite a bit. Property taxes typically are based on the value of the home. So that goes up. Homeowners insurance is based in part on the cost of the home, the cost to replace the home. So that's gone up. And then there have also been a lot of weather events and other things driving up insurance premiums.
Right.
But probably the biggest factor is just this housing boom that we've experienced since the pandemic. So the home prices have shot up. And the biggest part of our index is the estimated cost to maintain and repair a home. And we estimate that at 2% of the purchase price. So if you spent $300,000 for your house, you can expect to spend about $6,000 a year in ongoing maintenance and repairs. Obviously not $6,000 every year. Some years it might be only a couple thousand, other years it might be $10,000 or $20,000. It just depends on what's going on with your house. But that's sort of the rule of thumb that we use to estimate these ongoing maintenance costs.
Yeah. And you know, I would argue maybe that electricity, internet, cable, those kinds of things could actually maybe be stripped out because renters have to pay those things, too, in most cases. So those really shouldn't come as a surprise. But the other things that you were mentioning, particularly just how much home repairs and maintenance cost, do probably come as a shock, particularly for first-time homeowners, which is one of the reasons why this is so concerning.
Yes. Yeah. And as a longtime homeowner myself, I'm just constantly amazed at how much I'm spending on small things like, you know, lawn care or painting rooms, painting the exterior of the house.
Right.
And big things like you've got to replace the AC every 10 to 15 years. You got to replace the roof. garage door openers have to be replaced. Just all these things really add up. And so, as you mentioned, I think that's probably unclear to a lot of first-time buyers. They don't know what they're getting into. And so they've been saving and scraping up money for the down payment, and they're thinking that the purchase is the finish line, but really it's just a starting line for another set of expenses that you have to contend with.
And when you were talking about some of those numbers, I found it particularly eye-opening. When you total all of these things up, it comes to an average of $1,500 a month or so, according to the report, which for me would double my house payment. So it's certainly not a stretch to say that these hidden expenses could potentially put people maybe even in jeopardy of losing those homes.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's a real danger right now, just because the housing market is so strong, home prices have gone up so much. So, I mean, if a homeowner truly can't afford the house, you can sell your way out of it. And hopefully make some money. And now, going back to what you mentioned about electric bills and cable bills, so those aren't a mystery to most people just because they've been paying those as renters.
Right.
And then the property taxes and the insurance shouldn't be mysteries as well, because the lender bases their underwriting in part on how much you're going to pay for property taxes and insurance. And oftentimes they're collecting escrow payments for those. So that shouldn't be too much of a surprise. It certainly is possible that your property taxes could go up, and more likely that your homeowner's insurance premium could go up. But really, you're right. The ongoing maintenance and repairs, that is a kind of an unknown. It can be a real surprise.
Yeah.
And that's why we really encourage homeowners to save for that.
Yeah. The good news, as you mentioned, is that Ohio is kind of closer to the bottom of the state-by-state list than we are to the top. But the percentage increase from 2020 to now is in line with that national average.
Exactly. Yeah. Back to the 2% number. I mean, it's in a market like Ohio, it actually might be a little more than 2%. In a place like California, it's probably a little less than 2%. We applied this one number to the entire country. In a market like Ohio, where your land costs are proportionately less of the price of the property, mm-hmm. you're not paying to maintain and repair the land. You're paying to maintain and repair the house. So it might, maybe even a little more than 2% might be the right number for Ohio homeowners.
Yeah. So bottom line on all of this, and again, the reason that it's important to talk about, it's easy to say that the costs are too high. Of course, they're too high, but they're not going to come down anytime soon. So the question becomes what to do about it. And you said it's about making sure that people go in eyes wide open, that they are setting aside the money that they're going to need to cover these expenses.
Exactly. And so the lenders do build in some safeguards. So I mentioned that they include the property taxes and the homeowner's insurance is sort of an expected cost. And so the lender is determining whether you can afford that based on your income. Lenders also typically want to see some cash cushion. So if in 6 months after you move into your house, the water heater breaks, you're not putting that on a credit card and paying 20% interest. Mm-hmm. The real risk is that homeowners are going to be house poor. They're not going to have enough cash for these ongoing repairs, and they're going to run up big credit card bills. So essentially, until you've built up a pretty hefty emergency savings account, you want to treat homeownership almost like, or treat your budget as a homeowner almost like you did as you were saving for a home. So, before you bought, you were setting aside money for the down payment. Now you need to be setting aside money for these ongoing maintenance costs and repairs. Yeah. And then in a few years, as you've built up some equity and some cash reserves, then you'll have a little bit more flexibility. So a lot of homeowners now are taking out home equity loans or home equity lines of credit to fund major renovations.
Yeah. You either end up in a situation where you're adding to your debt load to make these necessary maintenance or repairs, or just ignoring them, which is equally bad. Again, Bankrate analyst Jeff Ostrowski was with us this morning talking about their latest hidden costs of home ownership study. We will link up to that on our webpage if you want to dig into some of the numbers. Really interesting stuff. Jeff, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot. Enjoyed it.
Well, joining us on the line this morning, Congressman Bob Latta, with us to talk about some of the timely issues on Capitol Hill these days. Congressman, thanks very much for taking the time. First of all, we appreciate it this morning, as always.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Thanks very much.
There are a number of things I want to touch on here. A couple of things. You recently penned or co-authored an op-ed piece for The Hill advocating the streamlining of the process of energy permitting. It had to do with increasing domestic energy production. And actually, you say this would benefit the further development of clean energy alternatives. Talk a little bit about, kind of summarize this for us.
Well, thanks very much. And I'm a ranking member on the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important things we see out there is, of course, that this country needs more energy, not less. The question I pose to everyone that comes before our committee, I ask that exact question. Do we need more energy in this country or do we need less? I even got the Secretary of Energy to even admit that we have to have more energy. But one of the things that really is one of the roadblocks out there is the permitting process that we have in this country. In a lot of cases, you may be talking 7 to 10 years, and in some cases, I just talked to someone recently just to try to open up a new mine. They started working on it in 1987, and they're finally going to start getting something out of the ground this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at the timelines that we have out there, we're falling behind, and it's absolutely essential that we do these things because, again, you might have the energy sources available in this country, but we can't get to them. And I've never had anybody ever tell me in committee or any place else that's in the industry that they're against regulations. But they all say the same thing. Give us regulations we can live with.
So
we need to make sure, I'm sorry, we get this done.
So that's the big question is obviously oversight is important for a myriad of reasons. So how much can you reasonably trim that time? I mean, you know, the example that you cited is obviously far too long to develop energy sources in this country. But what would be a reasonable amount of time?
Well, you know, again, reasonable, it can be what you might assume that it's going to take to get something done. You shouldn't have roadblocks being put up, just to be bringing up roadblocks, or to allow a party that was not, let's say you had a lawsuit or a permitting process that was going on, and all of a sudden after it's all done, they step in and want to file another lawsuit. They should have been involved early on, not at the tail end, where they know what they're going to do is just make it harder for this to go forward. Because again, every time we see these length of times being extended, that runs up the cost, not only for getting that production going, but it's going to also affect the end user who's going to be the consumer.
You know, you talk about the importance of domestic energy, and I think most everyone would agree that we need to be producing more of our own energy in this country. And yet earlier this year, you actually opposed the Biden administration's proposed ban on exports of liquefied natural gas, LNG exports. Why does it make sense to oppose keeping that domestic energy source in this country?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our allies around the world really need our energy, especially when we look at Western Europe. The Western Europe is now looking to start importing more of what? Russian natural gas. Why? Because, again, the Biden administration, in doing what they did, is curtailing us to get that liquefied natural gas to them. But if you go back to the whole process, is that if we don't have Americans out there drilling and bringing up the gas, all of a sudden things start slowing down in the fields. And that means the pipe production, to get the pipe to where it needs to go, the employees out there that are working. So we need to keep everybody working. And because what's happened in this country is that we were told in the 1970s and 1980s we had no natural gas in this country. And because of great entrepreneurism and innovation in this country, we are now the number one producer of natural gas in the world. And to point out, we do it much more clean than any place else, especially when you look at how dirty Russian natural gas is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're producing a very good product, but at the same time, if we don't keep bringing it up, it's going to stop the flow of the work being done out there, and all of a sudden, these fields just start shutting down. And all of a sudden, the Americans are going to find out they also don't have the natural gas.
Couple of other issues that I want to ask you about. Just a few days ago, in fact, the House of Representatives approved the annual defense legislation, the Service Member Quality of Life and National Defense Authorization Act. I know you were a big supporter of that. Kind of gloat a little. What does this bill do? What does this act do for those who are involved in national defense?
Well, you know, first and foremost, our number one duty as a member of Congress is to protect this country, and we have to have a strong national defense. When you look at the threats that we're getting from communist China, North Korea, Iran, and, of course, Russia, these are all adversaries of the United States. We have to make sure that we always keep our guard up. But one of the big parts in this legislation is to really help what we call our those in the lower ranks, especially your E1 through E4, mm-hmm. We're looking at giving these individuals about a 20% pay increase. Everyone else get about a 4.5% increase. You know, it's not right that these young men and women and that we ask that defend us in the military, and a lot of times have to go out and try to get on food stamps or survive. That's how low the pay is.
Yeah.
So one of the big things we want to do is make sure we're taking care of our people. We also want to make sure we're taking care of the military families out there, because, again, they make a tremendous sacrifice when their loved ones are deployed for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, or a year. And we want to make sure we take care of them. So a big part of this bill is making sure that we take care of our men and women in uniform and also the families, but at the same time, providing them with the tools they have to make sure that they can carry out their mission.
I want to ask you about something that we were actually talking on the program. We're talking about on the program yesterday morning, and that is election security. And I know that you are not on the Appropriations Committee, but even though this has been one of the most buzzed about discussions really since the last presidential election, Republicans talk about protecting the integrity of the vote. Democrats talk about protecting poll workers from threat of violence. So if everyone agrees that this is an important issue, why is funding that that came out of the Appropriations Committee for election security grants, why is that funding being cut? It was actually, if I'm not mistaken, zeroed out in this latest appropriations to come out of committee. Why eliminate those grants if election security is such an important issue?
Well, first, you know, this is really, when you're looking at the on the appropriations side, the Republicans now have been in control of the House for a term now for two. This is the second year. And so we're going through the appropriation process, and we're going to have by the end of July, we're going to have all 12 appropriation bills done. We're going to send those to the Senate. And so when they're looking at these items out there, you know, are they actually needed, and what would those things be used for? And so I think that, you know, I do not serve on the Appropriations Committee. I serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee, but I do know that the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Tom Cole, is making sure that, you know, the dollars are spent wisely. And that it's, you know, because again, if you remember a few years ago, Nancy Pelosi, who's chair or speaker of the House, wanted to have this massive federal elections takeover of our states. And that's one of the things that we don't ever want to see happen. We want to make sure that states out there are the ones that are in charge of the election processes and not
absolutely
the federal government.
Absolutely. But the local election boards and the state election committees offices are saying that they need additional grants to do these things, to protect the integrity and the transparency of the elections, to protect poll workers, do all of these things that ostensibly we say are important. They are the ones that are saying we need additional funding in the form of these grants. They're saying we need more funding, not less. So would you support putting those funds back into that appropriations bill?
Well, and again, what we've done is we've gotten two of the 12 appropriation bills done. We did, as we just talked about, the National Defense Authorization Act. We've also done our, what we call our military construction and veterans affairs. Those have been passed out of the House since the Senate. The Appropriations Committee, I know, will take a hard look at, because we have the next 10 appropriation bills to do, and they'll take a hard look at to see what's out there. Because, you know, you and I have talked in the past that, you know, this year we're going to pay $870 billion just to pay the interest on the national debt. Pretty much when we spend money anymore, we're in a situation where we're going to have to borrow probably next year $1 trillion just to pay the interest. We're not paying down the debt, just to pay the interest on the debt. So this is why I think it's so important that what the Appropriations Committee is doing, they're going through this. And again, this is why you don't want to hear what they call an omnibus at the end of a year, where they put everything in what they call a Christmas tree, and all this money is being spent. Because again, we're spending money that we don't even have.
A valid point. And on that note, I want to get your thoughts real quickly on this. We're running short on time, but I do want to ask you about this, because former President Trump, in his visit to Capitol Hill last week, reportedly floated the idea of eliminating income taxes and replacing them with tariffs and fees of that nature, just eliminating income taxes altogether. And I thought that was rather interesting, because any student of history, and I know that you are a scholar of history, knows that prior to the income tax, that's how the federal government raised the money that it had. Was through tariffs on foreign goods, that kind of thing, and commerce and so on. What are your thoughts of the idea? Is that something that is viable on some level?
Well, you know, first, you know, the income tax is put into the U.S. Constitution, and we have an income tax. However, one of the things you always have to think about with a tariff is tariffs, you want to make sure it's just like what is out there. If you have a certain product that's being produced in this country, and another country's out there, like communist China, undercutting the United States and not selling at even a fair market value because the government's propping it up. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you really want to see where tariffs come into play. I know I have 86,000 manufacturing jobs in my district, and even when you get into small companies of maybe only 10 employees, those people are exporting. And so, you know, we make so much in this country that we've got to export it. But if all of a sudden you could be in what you call a tariff war,
right,
where another country would slap on tariffs against the U.S. products going out, and then all of a sudden it's putting people out of work in this country because we can't sell our products abroad.
Yeah, so
I think, you know, I think that, and again, you know, President Trump, I think, has floated, you know, some ideas out there. But I think, you know, one of the things is you want to just be careful on making sure that it does not hurt domestic production in this country, because we're dependent on also exporting in this country. And we could have other countries say, well, we're not just going to let the American products in either.
Fair enough. We will leave it there. Again, Representative Bob Latta with us this morning. Congressman, thanks very much for taking some time. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're listening to Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A Florida woman is facing charges in Polk County after authorities say something like McMayhem broke out in local McDonald's restaurant in Lakeland. Police department yesterday released details of the incident on Friday at the McDonald's restaurant. McMayhem, indeed. According to officers, customers in the drive-thru told the employee, Chastity Gardner, that their order was wrong. They were complaining because their orders were incorrect. That led to an argument, and Ms. Gardner, reportedly threw a drink at the customers that were complaining. The two of them then threw drinks back through the window at Ms. Gardner. So quite the scene. And at that point, police say that Ms. Gardner got her gun and went outside to confront the customers. The clerk, the cashier, the McWaitress when she pulled the gun on the customers. That's when the customers decided, maybe it's time to leave. But as they were trying to exit the drive-thru, Ms. Gardner allegedly shot at their car and struck it at least once. No one was hurt, but the 22-year-old McDonald's employee, whom I would imagine is now a former employee of the restaurant, was arrested for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Moral of the story, if you don't get, if your burger comes with pickles when it wasn't supposed to, just pick them off. Next time. Don't mess around. You never know. I'll just pick them off myself, It's okay. I'm okay with the extra mustard, I'll deal with it. Elsewhere in the broken news, this from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where a furniture store got a little excitement the other day. On Saturday afternoon, the Down Home Furniture Store in the Sioux Falls suburb of T, South Dakota, the Down Home Furniture Store, a car crashed into the building. Chief Operating Officer of the store, Zoe Hall, said the car did not destroy any furniture, but the building had some significant structural damage. And here's the kicker on this. The furniture store hadn't even opened yet. The store is scheduled to have its grand opening on July 13th, so they've got less than a month to fix it. That's pretty bad. You might want to think twice about opening a new store when your store is destroyed by a car driving through the building before you even open. That may be a bad sign. That is a bad omen. CEO, Ms. Hall, said they may have to, in conjunction with their grand opening, have a scratch and dent sale. She was kidding, of course. But that would be cute. Grand opening, scratch and dent sale. But I suppose it's a good way to get publicity, free publicity for your store, I suppose. There is that. Sometimes you don't have to go very far to find the broken news. Dateline Willoughby, Ohio. That is in what, Lake County, I believe? 19-year-old Jamarion Hill is facing charges after he reportedly tried to steal an ambulance on Sunday morning. Mr. Hill allegedly started driving away with a stolen ambulance at University Hospital's Lake West Medical Center. That is when a Willoughby Hills firefighter happened to be there, jumped into the ambulance, which eventually led to the ambulance crashing near the helipad. So he never even made it out of the parking lot, basically. The firefighter / paramedic suffered minor ankle and arm injuries, but he'll be fine. Mr. Hill faces several charges, including robbery, auto theft, and disrupting a public service. I don't know why he decided to steal an ambulance. Because it was there, I guess. Another one of those weird things that people sometimes steal for some reason. Let's see here. A couple of other items in the broken news from the international file this morning. A French woman is suing the telecom company that she worked for allegedly paying her for 20 years without giving her any work to do. They paid her for 20 years and didn't give her any work. Lawrence Van Wassenhove suffers from partial paralysis of her face and limbs. So she is disabled. In 2002, when she was transferred to another office within the company, the new location decided, rather than accommodating her special needs with her disability, they just pay her salary. They decided to just pay. Well, we don't want to accommodate her. We'll just pay her salary. To heck with it. She says she received payment for 20 years without working. And it's not the first time that she's tried to, she wanted to work. She said she first reported the situation to the High Authority for the Fight Against Discrimination, which is, I guess, sort of like the EEOC in this country. She reported this back in 2015. And her lawyer says work for a person with a disability means having a place in society, recognition, social bonds, etc., etc. And I get the dignity of work and all of that. But all the same, if you want to pay me for 20 years and not require any work, I'm okay with that. I would be okay with that. I would not complain if you want to pay me to not work for 20 years. I'd be fine with that. And now she's suing for even more money. And finally, in the broken news this morning, in the United Kingdom, you knew that this is only a matter of time before this happened. In the United Kingdom, a candidate will appear on the ballot in the general election next month who does not exist. A candidate who does not exist except in the realm of cyberspace, basically. An artificial intelligence candidate is running to represent the Brighton Pavilion area. An AI candidate. They call him AI Steve, and he will appear on the ballot. It is the brainchild of businessman Steve Endicott. He is the human behind the AI. And he said, quote, "I am the real politician who wants to go into parliament, but I am controlled by my co-pilot." His idea, it's actually kind of makes sense. His idea is to create a politician who can interact with its constituents on a 24/7 basis. Anytime you need to contact your representative, the AI bot, the AI representative would be available, right? Because they can work 24/7, never have to take a day off or anything like that. Constituents can ask the candidate questions regarding his political views at aisteve.co.uk. You knew it was only a matter of time. I'm just surprised this happened in the UK before it happened in this country. I'm envisioning something like the Wizard of Oz for the digital age. You know what I mean? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The AI Steve will say, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. It'd be like electing Max Headroom, if you will, you know? As an 80s reference for those of you of a certain age. There you go, those of us of a certain age. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
How to stay safe when a tornado threatens. The best thing to do is make sure you're prepared. Know your area's tornado risk. The Midwest has a greater risk for tornadoes. Know the signs of a tornado and sign up for your community's warning system. Pay attention to weather reports and identify and practice going to a safe shelter. Take an active role in your safety. Go to ready.gov and search tornado for more information. This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. It may be vacation and travel season, but this is the peak of that time when people are traveling. But these days, it seems like there are plenty of reasons to avoid flying. Between all of Boeing's issues, CEO of the company is going to be grilled today by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and all of the problems they have had certainly been well documented. Between that and passengers behaving badly, that really actually, it seems, is the biggest issue, reasons why people would avoid flying. These days, we are certainly always hearing about drama in the skies caused by all sorts of unruly behavior among passengers. But it seems that travelers consider some behavior far worse than other things. Of all of the bad behavior, all the things that you could do but shouldn't do on board a plane, there are some things that really stand out. Folks at YouGov polled a group of Americans who typically travel to find out their opinions on various bad behaviors that are typically experienced on a plane mid-flight, and some were universally hated. So if you have done any of these things, know that you are the problem. What they found was four behaviors in particular that are so bad that over 80% of those in the survey consider them unacceptable. Those would be letting children play in the aisleway, getting drunk, leaving your seat during turbulence, and watching a movie without headphones. So those are the four, with 86%, 82%, 82%, and 81% respectively on those four things, all above 80% is the worst behaviors of the worst. I would rank getting drunk way up there. Man, that really... Because that leads to so many other bad behaviors. But anyway, those are the top four. Other things considered highly unacceptable on board a plane, so keep these in mind the next time you fly, leaving trash in the seat back pocket. 79% hate when people do that. Not so much for themselves, but when, you know, the next passenger gets on board. If you are the next passenger and someone on the previous flight has left trash in the seat back pocket, yeah, that's annoying. 74% say using both armrests when there is someone next to you is bad behavior, is bad form. Don't use both of the armrests. And I have to admit, I have occasionally done that. I've got to stop myself from doing that, you know, sometimes because, you know, you're in there so tight and you don't typically think about it when you're sitting in a chair using both armrests. But you got to, you know, cognizantly, you know, remind yourself not to use both armrests. Let's see here. Eating strong smelling food. Yeah, that's that's really bad, especially when you're hungry. 68% said eating strong smelling food is a no-no, so don't do that. Not listening to the safety demonstration. 66%, two-thirds of passengers actually will judge you if you are not paying attention to the safety demonstration. Doesn't matter if you've flown umpteen million times and you've heard it all before, you really should pay attention. Exiting the plane before the person in the row ahead of you. 65% hate that, and I would put that way up there, even higher on the list. 51% of people say it is actually acceptable to ask someone to switch a seat with you. So we're appeared to be okay with that. Only 26% say that is bad behavior. Of course, how you react when someone says no is likely a whole other story. 55% say it is fine to recline the seat. Only 26% say that that is unacceptable. And if you have ever worried about bothering the person next to you in your row so that you can get up and go to the bathroom, don't worry about that. 76% of flyers in the survey say it is perfectly acceptable to ask the person next to you to get up and let you out so that you can use the lavatory, even if you have to wake that person up. If they're sleeping, you have to wake them up because you have to go. Only 6% say that is not okay. And I would say, yeah, that's fine. You got to go. You got to go. Much rather you go to the lavatory than, you know, have an accident, obviously. But interesting things to keep in mind the next time that you fly. Well, I believe, and I think it would be hard to argue with this, that this may be one of the most important agencies, volunteer opportunities that you would have in the community. And that would be CASA of Hancock County. They have an event scheduled this evening to introduce folks to what they do and why it is important. The message is clear and simple that every child deserves a voice. And joining us from CASA of Hancock County are Jennifer Bishop and Ashley Bell. Thanks very much for being with us this morning, ladies. We appreciate the time. First of all, talk a little bit about what CASA is to give people an idea for those who may not be familiar.
Yeah, well, thanks for having us, first of all. And CASA really is a program that advocates for children inside and outside of the courtroom. These children have experienced abuse, neglect, and we really just get our volunteers from the community, We train them. We don't send anybody in blind. And they will advocate for these kids. They meet with the kids. They find out what they need. And then they can advocate in the courtroom to the judge.
Because obviously a child can't really do that for themselves. And clearly, given the cases that we're talking about, you would think that this would ordinarily fall to the parent, but usually that is the problem in many of these cases. So they need that person. I've often said that it's intimidating. The idea of going before a judge is intimidating for adults quite often. So you can imagine what it would be like for a child.
Yeah, absolutely. It's intimidating. And I like to explain it like mom usually has an attorney, dad usually has an attorney. There's nobody to speak on behalf of that child and what they want.
Now,
so that's where we step
that
in.
Being said, you do not have to be an attorney to be a court-appointed special advocate.
Correct. No, you don't have to be an attorney. Like I said, these are volunteers from our community, and we train them. They go through quite an extensive training, and then they're set up to advocate.
So let's talk a little bit about that aspect of it. You don't send someone in without that training. It's not a legal degree, obviously, but it is rather extensive training.
Correct. Yeah. We go through, we put our volunteers through 30 hours of pre-service training.
Okay.
And then once they are a volunteer, they're required to have 12 hours of like a continuing education or like an in-service training per year. So we keep them up to date. Everything's always changing in the court system.
Right.
And with rules and regulations and things like that. So that's kind of where that 12 hours extra of pre-service comes in.
Mm-hmm.
If something has changed or if there's something that they need to know, or maybe they just feel like they don't know, they're not as comfortable with, we'll put them through that that extra training, and they kind of get it that way.
And so just from the training aspect, it's a pretty serious commitment. And then actually advocating for a child in a court case, and this is not a volunteer opportunity where if you're looking to do something, you know, 1 hour a month or, you know, 1 weekend a month or whatever, this is not that.
No, this is definitely not that. We really ask that our volunteers dedicate at least 12 months. Usually that's pretty much the life of a case.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they can go longer than 12 months. So we ask that they at least have that 12-month commitment.
And this is something that can be, frankly, I would imagine, very emotionally draining. It can take a lot out of you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's very draining.
And again, we don't say all of this to discourage people from doing it, because it is one of the most rewarding ways that you can volunteer your time.
Absolutely. We don't say it to discourage people, but we also want people to know that it's very emotional, and, mm-hmm. and some of the cases are very tough, but it's so rewarding. When you get those success stories, it's so rewarding.
You want people to go in with your eyes wide open.
Absolutely.
To something like this. There's an old saying that the military used to use with recruits. It's the toughest job you'll ever love. And I would imagine this is kind of the same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about this event that is coming up this evening. You have an event to kind of give people a big picture overview of what CASA is all about and what volunteers might be asked to do.
Yes. So this evening from 7 to 8 at Gateway North Main, we will be just having an informal, laid-back conversation. We've got some of our volunteers coming in, and people can ask questions as far as what they've gone through, what it takes, what their experience has been, and just we'll be there as well to give them more information on what it takes to get trained to be of CASA.
So you're not looking to hold people's feet to the fire if they come to this informational event. They're not committing to anything, just to learn more.
Correct.
No. When we talk about the experiences of the volunteers, the cases that they may see, and I know that we can't talk about specifics with respect to that, but what are the most common, what is the most common feedback that you get from people who have been through this firsthand? What are some of those stories like?
We see a lot of substance abuse. cases. There's a lot of babies that are born addicted. There's a lot of parents that struggle with the substance abuse, which in turn leads, you know, to the neglect piece of it too. So those are the biggest cases that we see on a regular basis.
This is a program that actually is run through the county court system, right?
Yeah.
Is part of, so there is that support on that end as well.
Absolutely. I know previously CASA was 100% nonprofit.
Yeah.
And then we were kind of umbrellaed under the court system. And Judge Johnson is amazing. The support of the CASA program has been outstanding. And she really cares about these kids and wants them to grow up and be successful.
Again, just to reiterate the fact that there is that support group behind the volunteers to help them along the way. Because, again, in most cases, they're not attorneys. They're not, you know, they're kind of lay people who are, if you will, going through this. And how many volunteers would you have? How many advocates would you have ideally to cover the caseload that you have?
Well, ideally, I would love to have one for every child, but we're a little bit short on that.
And that was what I was going to ask. How many do you have now? How many do you really need?
So right now we have 10, I think.
12.
Okay. So right now we have 12. We're actually holding a pre-service training currently, and we have, three extra. Okay. So we'll have 15.
Yeah. But again, more can always be
absolutely
used. I guess what I'm getting at is how big is this caseload? And, you know, are you significantly short with the number of cases? Do kids go without advocates if you don't have advocates?
So if we can't appoint a CASA volunteer, the juvenile court system will try and appoint an attorney GAL.
Okay.
So that at least there's somebody.
Right.
But
attorneys have their own caseload.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they don't always have the time that our volunteers have to, you know.
Because you would think, oh, well, you know, they'll appoint an attorney and that would be even better. But not necessarily, because, again, they have their own caseload to worry about.
Yeah, not necessarily. They do have their own caseloads. They're very busy as well. And so I think the attorney lens and the CASA volunteer lens are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thankful that we have attorney GALs that can step in when we don't have a CASA to appoint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. But that's the goal here, is that, you know, that's the reason why we talk about this, the reason we're having the informational event this evening, to make sure that in as many cases as possible doesn't happen.
Correct.
Yeah. Bottom line. So again, let's mention the details on this. If someone wants to learn more and perhaps get involved, it's not something that you would, you know, all of a sudden do the next day or the next week, but to get the process started, perhaps, give us the information.
All right, absolutely. So we will be at Gateway Church North Main at 620 North Main Street from 7 to 8 tonight. And it'll be myself and Ashley, along with some of our current CASA volunteers, just that informal sit down, ask questions about what it entails, maybe how many hours they spend volunteering a month, and what they've kind of gotten out of the program, and why they like being a CASA.
We've got a link up for more information about the event at our webpage. If you go to goodmornings.net, you can learn about that. Again, it is happening this evening. And if folks can't attend this evening, just reach out.
Absolutely. Yep, we're always more than happy to talk about it.
Again, a very clear and simple message that every child deserves a voice, and you can help be that voice. Your CASA of Hancock County, Jennifer Bishop, Ashley Bell, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. Our thanks to all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, do you know the most deadly weather danger is not tornadoes or hurricanes or even floods or lightning? It's heat. Yeah, that surprised me as well. We certainly have plenty of that this week, record amounts, in fact. We'll talk about how to recognize the signs when someone is in trouble and how to help. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.